So we are at the end of Perek Gimel, the end of chapter 3, page 959. Yes, actually, yes. So last time we did a quick read-through of chapters 3 and 4, we talked about the leadership vacuum that is either a punishment or a consequence of the conduct of corrupt leadership. The sin of the leaders was that they harmed the nation. We then talked about the haughty matron. We didn't talk about, we just gave a basic run-through of the description of the haughty and arrogant matrons and how God is going to remove their jewelry. Before concluding with the statement that God is going to cleanse Jerusalem of their sins before the arrival of Mashiach, and that brought us into the beginning of chapter 4, and the statement about the tzemach of God creating honor and desirability in the city. So there's a lot to talk about here in terms of language, which we're just not going to do because we'll never get anywhere. But there's a lot of the way he likes to play with words and sounds. I'll show you one thing just because you can't skip it. If you take a look at chapter 3, sentence 3. I'm sorry, it's sentence 5. Not sentence 3, sentence 5. You look at the Hebrew. V'nigash ha'am ish b'ish v'ish v're'ehu. You see that? He's playing games with you. He likes to play games with words. He has the dramatic pictures here, obviously, which we've noted, the poem with the jewelry. But what I wanted to do, one other note, I'm sorry, that I did want to take note of because I didn't last week. Go back to chapter 3, sentence 17, when he talks about the fate that is going to befall the daughters of Zion in their arrogance. So the word that he used, the verb he used, which they translate here as afflict, but it's not the point, is visipach Hashem kodkod benos tzion. God will be sipach. What does the word sipach really mean? Afflict is the wrong word. Chapter 3, sentence 17. No. Sorry?
I don't know. I think it's some kind of a disease.
It is. No, you got exactly what it is. It is indeed a disease. It is sapachat. Sapachat, which is the term we've noted, it means a mark of tzara'at. And that was the mark that King Uzziahu got on his forehead. When he went into the Beis HaMikdash, he tried to bring the Ketoret. This is another slap at King Uzziahu. God is going to put a sapachat on the heads of the daughters of Sion. That's what he did to Uzziahu. So this is another knock on Uzziahu that he's doing. He puts these things in there, and you have to be really focused in order to catch it. But what I wanted to spend time on in this to wrap up chapters 3 and 4 is the theme. What you're seeing here is a polemic, right? We're in the section of polemics. Chapters 1 through 5 are polemics. I think it's not a surprise by now. Chapter 1, a diatribe against corruption that takes advantage of the vulnerable. That's going to lead to the fall of Jerusalem. Chapter 2, you think that the way to elevate the Jewish world and Jerusalem and Judea is by building towers and expanding your land and fighting wars. No, the way that it's going to be elevated is when it represents God's message to the world, and then everybody will stream there and the mountain will be elevated above mountains and so on. In chapters 3 and 4, what we're seeing is a polemic against the self-indulgent. The people who are affluent and use it to aggrandize themselves and who take advantage of others. And you see a couple of targets within that. Debbie, you going to say? Or?
No, I'm just thinking that he's not talking about the women or the boys or the irreligious. He's talking about the nation of Israel.
Yeah.
So this is poetry.
No, these are images.
He's not talking about women, you know, who have no husbands should go find anybody who's Jewish so they won't be raped by the Gentiles. He's talking about the nation of Israel, really.
Oh, yeah. I think you're 100% right. I mean, it's layer upon layer, as it always is with poetry.
I don't tend to look at this as religiously. For me, you know.
Right. But one thing that's worth noting, just because you used the word, is he didn't say anything here at all about people's religiosity.
No, it talked about their idols, though, doesn't it?
Not in this chapter. Not in this set of chapters. Elsewhere, we had a brief reference to idolatry.
A false idol.
You know, earlier on.
Jewelry looking.
Right, but he didn't call. I'm just saying, he hasn't used the term idolatry at all in this segment that I can recall. The no, his images here are of bad leaders. And the image of the wealthy and corrupt women. What I found really striking was the way that Talmud looked at this. Take a look at source number one, please, on your sheet. I thought this was very, very interesting. Shmona Esrei Klalot. Shmona Esrei Klalot. Kilel Yeshaya Es Yisrael. Isaiah cursed Israel 18 times. Meaning in this section. He's got more than 18. V'lon iskara da'ato asha amar lehem hamikra hazeh. And he didn't calm down until saying the following verse. Yerhavu hanar bizakein v'hanikleb v'nichvad. The youth will reign over the aged, the lowly over the honored. Which was, of course, in chapter 3, towards the beginning of the chapter. That's the point where he calmed down. And what struck me about this...
It's Marxist.
Marxism. No, it's not. What struck me about this is that it imputes emotion to Yeshaya. In other words, the Navi is not an objective conduit for God's message. God is disappointed in us. God wants to express anger at us, whatever. And the Navi is just the stenographer, and you know, through whose mouth this is conveyed. Or the visionary who sees a picture and then translates it into even his own words and poetry. The Gemara sees Yeshaya as emotionally invested in this. This is personal for him. He is angry at the leaders he sees who are taking advantage of the vulnerable, and he can't calm down. The only way that he can reach some level of calm is by expressing the rebuke and saying, "You should know what's coming." You see what I'm saying? It's personal for him, which we're going to see again in chapter 5. We're going to see it be personal for him there as well. Yeah?
It's just so interesting because the message is from God, and each one of the prophets gives their own color to it, or their own...
they interpret a vision they see.
Delivering it, and yet it's interesting how, like, when do we divide what comes from God and what comes from the instrument
right.
delivered?
And that's going to also be a question when we see chapter 5, as we'll see very shortly. That question of what you attribute to the Navi. You know, when you deal with Ruach HaKodesh, which is supposed to be a lower level than Nevuah, right? Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. We talk about that as God building up or strengthening that which is already in the person. That's what Ruach HaKodesh is supposed to be. As opposed to sending the person a message, it's God saying, that instinct you have, that's really good. I'm going to amplify that for you. And that's both in action and in the speech that the person might author. That's the Rambam's discussion, which we will see again in the beginning of chapter 5. But with Nevuah, it's more a sense of God is sending them a vision, which they may like or not like. Right? Yonah can't stand the vision he's been given. That's not something coming from him at all. But with Yeshaya, it's very much in consonance. The message he is getting from God fits with what he already believes and expresses that which he passionately feels. Which may explain, actually, come to think of it, I hadn't thought about it this way, but it may explain what happens in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is going to be his initiation as a Navi. God is going to say, who can I send? And he's going to say, pick me. And you look at that and you're kind of stunned because, wait, that's not what Nevi'im normally do. Moshe says, I don't want anything to do with this. Yirmiyahu says, who am I? I'm a kid. I can't do that. And Yeshaya is jumping up and down. Because for him, this message is exactly what he wants to say. And I think that's what the Gemara is telling us here. This is not only a matter of I'm God's employee and here's the message God told me to deliver today. This is personal for Yeshaya. He grows up among this aristocracy. He lives in Judea. He sees what the leaders are doing. and he is angry. That's what the Gemara is telling you. Susan?
Is he angry for future generations' loss of baby Judaism? Or is he angry because... Like, what? Well, it's personal because they're his friends, because he knows them, or because there's no future for
I would just go with what he says. Which is, I mean, look at sentence 12 in chapter 3. Right? It's the fact that they torture their nation. The fact that they lead them improperly. It could be that he's concerned about where this is going to have an impact in the future, but it looks to me like he's angry for where things are right now. Take a look, please, at source number 2. Also a passage from the Gemara. Part of a much broader passage dealing with the issue of responsibility when you're part of a community and some people are committing wrong, even if it's not you. So the Gemara here asks about Yeshaya's message here. My dichsiv, what does it mean when someone had suggested last time and I thought they were right and I forgot to implement it. I'm going to read only the English parts of the sources, even though I'm going to continue to bring the original Hebrew for authenticity. I'm going to read out only the English just because it will chop off about 20 minutes of each hour and then we can get in more material. So I thought that made a lot of sense. So what is the meaning of the text when it says God will come in judgment with his elders and nobles, which was, again, part of chapter 3? The Gemara asks, if the nobles sinned, how do the elders sin? The nobles are sinning. This whole thing seems to be a diatribe against the nobility. It has nothing to do with the elders. So the Gemara answers, rather, you should read it as upon the elders for not protesting against the nobles. The religious leaders are liable for not reining in the political leaders. They should have done something, effective or not, to rein in the political leadership, and they didn't. And the result is that the leaders are deposed and new leaders are put in place. That's part one of this polemic. The other piece of it is about the wealthy and corrupt women, who we read about starting in sentence 16 and running all the way to the first verse in chapter 4. So I'm going to tell you the way it's usually taken and then give you what I find to be a very novel perspective. Just as I find it as so novel, it definitely has to be explored. The general view is that this is a broad polemic against zinut, against sexual immorality. In fact, the opening passage here, or not the opening passage, but the passage in general, is the basis for the Gemara in Yuma, which we talked about a while back. Janine had asked about it, where the Gemara says, she's not here this week, she's traveling. But the Gemara in Yuma had said that the sins at the end of the first temple included arayot, included immorality. The Gemara draws it from our chapter here, from this message right here. The Abarbanel, though, is bothered by that. He says, time out. Does immorality warrant the utter destruction of Jerusalem? Is that really what warrants the... You just blow up the city as a result of this immorality? So take a look at Abarbanel in source number 3. He says, the intent of the prophet was not to say that all of this evil would happen because of the sin of arrogance found in the daughters of Zion, right? Which is the way that it's presented. All of the evil which befell Judea in the time of Ahaz was really for the sin of idolatry and the other sins found in that generation, in the king, in the nation, misleading others, corrupting others, and so forth. But it's said that when so many of them would die in battle, if that's going to happen because they're going to fall in war, then their arrogance and ornamentation would disappear from the women and their crowns would be removed from them. In other words, it's a consequence. It's not, this is the punishment. The fall of Jerusalem is because of the bad leaders. The fall of Jerusalem is because of the idolatry that was mentioned a couple of chapters ago. That's what causes Jerusalem to fall. And then the women who had been arrogant and the women who had sinned with the men, all of that is going to collapse as a function of the general collapse of the city, not as a cause of the collapse of the city. So that's one take, and I think that's a fairly standard read. But then Rav Yosef Carmel of Eretz Chemda has his remarkable view in his Sefer Tzofnat Yeshayahu, which I thought was worth spending a little bit of time on. I gave you a link where you can find it on the 929 website. You can find his essay on this. He says, look more carefully at this section and you will find that there are actually two groups of women. It's not one group. If you go back to chapter 3, sentence 16, again on page 959, it talks about ki gavhu benot Tzion. The daughters of Zion are arrogant. They are haughty. And then you see the description of the punishment that is going to befall them. That's 16 and 17. And then there's a separate issue, which is starting in number 18, the women who wear all of their jewelry, the women who are all adorned. And these are actually, he says, two different groups that God is angry about. The first group is the ones who are wealthy and who live the lives of pleasure and arrogance. Now, because most of you were not here when we learned Amos, so we're going to take a fast look at Amos chapter 4. If anyone finds where this is and wants to call it out. Oh, there it is. Thanks. Yeah, 1361 or 59? Yeah, 1361. Thank you. Chapter 4, sentences 1 to 3. Just look at his opening. Shim'u hadavar hazeh. Listen up to this. Parot habashan. You cows of Bashan. That's the start. It doesn't get nicer. This image that he uses, which again, go back to what Debbie said before, is really about the powerful who take advantage of others, right? He talks about who crush the destitute and, you know, who say to their lords, bring so that we can drink. It's the people who are self-indulgent. That's your first group. But the second group, the ones with all of the jewelry, he says, that's something different. And he seizes on, go back now to Yeshaya, page 959, he seizes on the odd thing that happens at the end of chapter 3. After the list of jewelries, chapter 3, sentence 25. He interrupts his prediction of what's going to happen to these women. He talked about these women. In sentence 24, he said, in place of their perfume, there will be decay, and so on, right? Sentence 24 is what's going to happen to the women. And then suddenly, in sentence 25, he talks about how they're going to fall in battle. And therefore, he goes back to the women, and he says the women are going to sit on the ground, and they're going to go looking for a man to shelter them, and so on. How did that fall in battle fit into the description of the women? So what he floats as an idea is something that we're familiar with as a more modern phenomenon, which is the groups of women who attach themselves to a military camp. That's what he says this is talking about. They get dressed up and so on to be with the soldiers. And that's the group that he's talking about here, and so it makes sense. They collapse when the army collapses. And then he goes further with it. He applies this to Shirat Devorah, Devorah's song. At the end of Devorah's poem about their victory, where Sisera's mother talks about Sisera and his soldiers taking from the spoils and all of that, and that in her mind is him raiding from the Jewish camp the women who have attached themselves to the Jewish camp. That's the way that he reads that. And then he also says, and this I thought was a really interesting idea, that's what Eshet Yifat Tohar is about. Okay. Right.
What does that mean?
I'm going to explain it, don't worry. If you see the reference I gave you on the sheet, and in source number 4, Devarim chapter 21, sentences 10 to 13, the Torah gives you, in the middle of the book of Devarim, rules for military conduct. Calling for peace, how to do a siege, the types of destruction, how you run your military camp in terms of cleanliness and various other factors. And in the middle of this, it gives you the law of the Eshet Yifat Tohar, which is such a horrifying circumstance. What it says is, when you, the soldier, are out there in battle, and you see Eshet Yifat Tohar, a beautiful woman, so this is what you shall do. Take her home, and let her spend 30 days letting her nails grow, and letting her hair grow, and crying for her family, and her idols, or whatever it is, and then afterwards, you can marry her. And the passage is just so antithetical to everything that we've been taught and everything we're supposed to do. Here you are in the middle of a book. The book of Devarim is practically dedicated to saying, stay away from the non-Jewish women. Right? I mean, that's like a constant refrain in the book. They're going to lead you to idolatry. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do... Oh, by the way, women in wartime, yeah, this is what you should do. Such that the sages look at it and say, clearly, this is just a concession to a Yetzer Hara. You're talking about a soldier who is, you know, inverting all of the morality he was ever taught. He was always taught, don't steal, don't harm people, don't kill, and so on. Now he's being told to do the opposite, and that's his barometer of success. If you don't give him a way to do this, it's going to be worse. So tell him he has to wait 30 days, and he'll cool off in the meantime, and this will be your way to deal with it. That's the simple and standard understanding of the text.
Does that just mean she's not pregnant?
She's not pregnant at that point.
Well, for 30 days...
Nothing's happened. There's a debate between Rashi and Tosfot as to whether anything happens before the 30 days at all. But no, this isn't about seeing, oh, you were seeing if she's pregnant from before. You need 3 months. I didn't get it. But yeah, you need 3 months then. Not 30 days. So that's sort of the usual read of the story. Is that this is a concession to the Yetzer Hara. Let me just get through his idea, and I know there are a lot of comments and questions, and I'll deal with it. But what his argument is that Eishet Yifat Tohar doesn't mean you encountered a woman and she happens to be beautiful. It's a woman who is there for that reason. It's the women of the military camp. And that's what you're seeing there, and that's what Yeshaya here is coming to condemn.
Ask a question, yeah. Because I really don't know how the women get there. Are they forced to be there?
Think ISIS. Think ISIS. These women who went to become
right.
You're asking about a historical phenomenon, and from what I understand, it's a blend. There are cases in which people are forced into it. The ISIS example would be one of them. But there are also cases in which it's this is what they do. This is how they survive. They what was the term in Japan? The comfort women?
Yeah. Oh, they were forced. They were forced.
Government were forced?
They were forced.
Okay, that I did not know.
Those were Chinese women who were forced.
That's why they asked for refugees.
Got it. Okay, right. I wasn't aware.
But in ISIS, we saw these young women going from all over the Muslim world to become...
Oh, you're talking about... Okay.
So that's what
yes, the answer is it's an
ideology.
It's based on... It's sometimes it's ideology. Sometimes it's this is the winning team and I want to attach myself to them for protection. I think that you'll see it in different ways in different cultures in different eras. But that's his idea. Okay, there were a lot of questions. But I just wanted to show you that that's what he connects to this passage here. And I found the Eishet Yifat Tohar Association fascinating. Yes?
So, after 30 days, and he's not interested in her anymore, what happens?
She goes back home.
So it's the fire.
Yeah. What? No, I mean, that's what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk says, nah. The Pasuk says, Vayan lo chafatz taba, if you don't want her, v'shilachta l'nafsha, send her off for herself. And it says specifically, umachor lo yim karena bakasef, you are not allowed to sell her for money, lo tit amer ba, and you shall not abuse her. So the answer is, you let her go. I mean, she's from the losing side in this war. I don't know where she's going. But you can't harm her, abuse her, take her as a slave. None of those are options. Yeah. Okay. So other questions or thoughts on this? I told you this was a unique take. This is not your standard read of this passage.
Smart. It's so smart.
Yeah.
It's involved.
He's pretty smart.
And why these women who aren't, who are too sexual and not modest, why they are damned? Because why are you damned? Just because you've got a lot of jewelry and good taste. Well...
No one said good taste here.
Okay, but that's what it sounds like. These are the immoral women, and these are the women who are over the top, okay? What's wrong with that? Well, they're not really just over the top. They're camp followers.
Right. Right. So what you get here at the end of this, now that we understand what his polemic is about, is a statement from God in chapter 4 that he is going to purify Jerusalem of all of this. In the future, if you take a look at chapter 4, sentence 2, so at the top, page 961, he says, you will be elevated, just like he said in chapter 2, for all the right reasons, right? On that day, the tzemach, and again, whatever tzemach is we talked about last time, will come forth for splendor and honor. The fruit of the land will be for pride and glory for the survivors of Israel. They will be declared kadosh. They will be declared to be holy. You will be elevated. Something else that Dat Mikra suggests, which I have to admit, not being expert enough in Yeshayah to say this myself, but they are, take a look at source number 4, what Amos Chacham writes in the Dat Mikra commentary, in his introduction to Yeshayah. He says, Isaiah's prophecies do not include explicit prophecies of punishment regarding future destruction of Jerusalem. Isn't that interesting? He says, if you read through Yeshayah, you don't find what you will indeed find in other prophets where they envision Jerusalem destroyed. Even in chapter 1, as horrific as that was, Yeshayah never envisions Jerusalem destroyed. I thought that was a very interesting note that he made. Like I said, I couldn't say that. My knowledge of Yeshayah is not complete enough for that, but that's Amos Chacham, yeah, when he says that, you take it seriously. And then the last bit on this, and then we'll move on to chapter 5. Yeah?
What word means raise? Where do you get the raise?
We saw that in chapter 2 was the elevation.
Oh, yeah.
I'm saying that this is like that vision in the sense here he doesn't use the term raise, but he talks about them being declared sanctified.
Okay.
Take a look at sentence 5, please. The last bit here. In chapter 4, correct. So he describes, again, a cloud by day and smoke and the illumination of a flame at night. Right? So we noted last time, this is like the departure from Egypt, traveling in the wilderness. So what is this? Radak says it's literal, meaning just like that happened when you came out of Egypt, that's what's going to happen now. But Abarbanel says no. Take a look at source number 6. Abarbanel first goes through the question of, well, if this is literal, has this ever happened? Is it a prediction for a messianic time? And so on. But then take a look at number 6. He says, Omer ani, he says, I say that this is all a parable. This whole idea of the pillar of smoke and the flame, it's a parable. It's not meant literally. And what it says is that in the time of King Chizkiyahu, God will guard Jerusalem and its inhabitants amazingly. That was the best I could do. With superior protection. Which sounds like some like pimple cream, but Hashkacha Ma'alia. Shmira Ma'alia. With superior protection. Like the day when they ascended from the land of Egypt. This is a metaphor. What it means to say is, God will help us as He did when we left Egypt, which is a theme we're going to see across Sefer Yeshayah. Yeshayah loves that theme. The idea that just like certain things happen when you left Egypt, they're going to happen for you again in the future when you come back to the land. That's an ongoing theme for him in this book, crossing from the beginning of it all the way through the end. It's one of the elements that really unifies the Sefer. Okay, so that wraps up chapters 3 and 4.